in your prayers. We're thankful for those who are worshiping today from other places, and we're glad that you've come, and we hope that you'll be benefited by the things that we do together this morning. There is a blunt verse in Psalm 14. In fact, it is the very first verse of Psalm 14, where the psalmist just simply says, "The fool has said in his heart that there is no God." You know, there's a number of things I wouldn't want to be called, but a fool is one of them. But yet God says that is exactly what he would say to the person who says that there is no God. "Thou fool." The Bible's claim is that it is so clear that there is a God. In fact, I've often thought about Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, where the Bible just starts off without any kind of explanation. The Bible just simply says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And as we're going to continue to state this morning, I believe that the created world is designed in such a way to make us grope for God and eventually to lead us to the written word. And I've often thought that when a person picks up the Bible for the very first time, he could not help but be struck with the fact that what I'm looking for, this book's claims that I have found. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. No lengthy explanation about that, just a stated fact that it was done by the God of heaven. But have you ever thought about what a person is really saying when he says, "There is no God"? For example, imagine that I had lost my watch, and I'm convinced that I lost it somewhere in the house, but maybe not. At least I'm thinking I've lost it in my house. And then after looking around for a while, I just simply say, "My watch is not in this house." Well, for me to say that my watch is not in this house is to imply that I have searched every nook and cranny. I have not missed a single inch of this house, high and low, up and down, all around. It's not in this house. It implies I've been everywhere. So what does it imply when a person says there is no God? It is to imply that he has been everywhere. He has searched every nook and cranny of this entire universe to the point that he thinks he can boldly say there is no God. But let me ask you this. If you could search out every aspect of this universe, what would that make you? I'd suggest to you it would make you God, that he's the only one who can do that. And so to say that there is no God is the height of cockiness, and really it is to set yourself really in being in the place of God. This lesson this morning is very personal. I'm just simply pointing out why I believe in God. The picture on the screen is one that Susan took some years ago that caught our attention. There was a great canopy of clouds, and yet, you know, sometimes it works that way, that a cloud will open up and there'll just be a couple of holes, and the sun shines through those openings. And it's almost like God is saying, "I am in your world." And so I speak to you this morning about why I believe in God. To me, it is so hard for me to understand how others just say that they can't see him. We're looking at the same world. We're looking at the same world, and yet they say there is no God, and here I am saying, indeed, there is a God. To me, he just jumps out of everywhere. For example, I have used this illustration as I think about the fact that I can see him in the material world. As we look at the screen, what does that say? Someone looks at it and says, "Well, that verse or that says that God is nowhere." I look at it and I say, "No, that's not what it says at all. That says God is now here." So there's an example of how two people can be looking at the same thing. One says God is nowhere. The other one says that God is now here. But the truth about the matter is that God is not hiding. His trademarks are all around us, and yet some people say, "Well, if you can't see God, if you can't hear God, if you can't touch God, then he doesn't exist." Some years ago, there was a story that circulated about a college classroom that indicated that if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And a college student was in a philosophy class. By the way, we have some kids here today from Florida College. And a while back, I was talking to some of the administrators there. And that was one of the things that one of them said, that there is just a marked difference in what is spoken in a philosophy class at a place like that, or as compared to what you might get here at Calhoun Community College. And he talked about all that he was fed in the philosophy class in courses of the world. But anyway, the professor presented this following logic. Has anyone in this class heard God? And no one spoke. Has anyone in this class touched God? Again, nobody spoke. Has anyone in this class ever seen God? And when nobody spoke for the third time, he then simply said, there is no God. One student raised his hand and then asked for permission to reply. Curious to hear this bold student's response, the professor granted it, and the student stood up and asked the following questions. Has anyone in this class heard our professor's brain? Silence. Has anyone in this class touched our professor's brain? Again, absolute silence. Has anyone in this class seen our professor's brain? When nobody in the class dared to speak, the student concluded, then, according to our professor's logic, it must be true that our professor has no brain. I think that pretty well says it. You haven't heard it. You can't see it. You can't touch it. So by the very same logic, you would have to conclude that he has no brain. And if it be a true story, I'm told that he received an A in the class for offering such logic. Perhaps it was a test. God is not hiding. In Gardendale, Alabama, there's a friend of mine there. His name is Rusty Green. Some of you know Rusty. And Rusty works for GE, and some time back he was working on some kind of machine that does these scans of people's head. And they used him as a test. And so he came back with this little image. And he said, there's the proof. I do have a brain. But yet, you know, without that kind of imaging, it would be true that you don't hear it, you don't see it, you don't touch it. So therefore, the conclusion would have to be, we don't have brains. And yet the evidence is, indeed, we do have them. Every single one of us do have them. So that kind of logic will just not stand up. And God is screaming in the world that we are in that there is a God. Turn to Acts, the 14th chapter, and notice what Acts chapter 14 says. Paul and his travel companions here have just healed a person who was lame, crippled from his mother's womb. And as soon as they heal that man, the response is, the gods have come down to earth. And so they begin, they want to worship. They want to worship Paul and Barnabas. And in verse 15, the response is, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and we preach that you should turn from these vain things to the living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Verse 17, nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness. That's a strong verse. God has not left himself with no witnesses at all, but rather it says that he did good. And he gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. He says God has not left himself without witness. Every time it rains, the thoughtful person can realize that things down here cannot grow without rain, and somebody is providing what is needed for life here below. He did good. He gave us rain. He gave us rain from heaven, fruitful seasons, and he has filled our hearts with food and gladness. And so the argument of Acts chapter 14 is that a logical thinking person can look at the world, he can see the evidence that is there, and he can conclude that not only there is a God, but there is a God who cares for us. And he wants to take care of us. Now turn to Psalm 19. In Psalm 19, David stated it yet another way. Psalm 19. In Psalm 19, beginning in verse 1, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. In other words, you can look at the heavens and you can see the magnificent glory of God. And the firmament shows his handiwork. So it seems to me that maybe the first verse would include the stars and the planets, the moon, the sun. The firmament, of course, includes those things as well. He shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. And I love verse 3. Verse 3 says, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. In other words, there is a voice that goes out through the entire world. It doesn't matter whether you are in China or Japan or whether you are in Hungary or the United States of America. It doesn't matter what language you speak. Everyone can understand the message that is being preached by the universe, and that message is, there is a God. There's no speech nor language where that voice is not heard. It may be stomped on. It may be squelched. But nevertheless, that voice is out there screaming at all of us. Verse 4 says, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And perhaps the verse that we are most familiar with is Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, reading beginning in verse 18. Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. It says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. You need to know that one of the reasons people press down the truth and want to squash and cover up the truth is because they don't want to live right. There are a lot of people that I am convinced reason this way, that if there is a God, then I'm accountable to Him. And if I'm accountable to Him, I've got to change the way I live. And I don't want to do that, so no God. They suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. He then says in verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. You can look at man and you can look at the things around man and you can see that God is trying to show us His existence. Verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Since the creation of the world, it says, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, meaning you might not can see God, but you can see His attributes. Can we not look at the world and see, and the universe, and see extreme power? I'll tell you this, it's more than I've got. And we see extreme intelligence, far more than I would ever happen to have. And we see artistic design and creativity. I often tell people, God just went wild. He went wild when He made all the things in the earth. You ever thought about that? Not just a tree, but trees. And not just a flower, but flowers. And not just insects, but tons of them. And not just animals, but tons of them. It's like God just said, what's this? And what's this? And what's this? And He just exploded upon us. A beautiful and wonderful and vast creation. And so we can see that it's obvious man didn't do this. It points to God, and that's what's meant in the verse when we said we see Godhead or divinity. We see a divine power. But also we see eternal power, power beyond anything that any man can do. And this is what the world screams to us, which is why I have pointed out to you a number of times about the young man who was killed in a tragic accident in Gardendale. Actually, it happened in Tennessee. His name was Justin Nash. Justin was a young man who was 17 years old. He was an aspiring cartoonist. His daddy made that dream come true later by putting all of his cartoons in a book and having various ones to write spiritual articles about those cartoons. This is even on his grave. If you were to go to his tombstone, you would see this very picture scrolled across his tombstone. It's got a young man laying out on the back 40, far back from the house. He's looking up at the stars and the moon and all of those things, and he just simply says, atheists must not get out much. That's Romans 1. Romans 1 is teaching that a man can look at the created world and he can conclude what is the obvious thing about God. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I was reading recently a book called Jesus and Muhammad. And it's about a man, it's written by a man who left Islam. He had learned the entire Quran. He had learned what they refer to as hadith, which is the traditional things that are written about Muhammad that are not in the Quran. And he had memorized all this stuff, was an excellent student, was even teaching in one of their schools, but he had serious questions. And he began to throw out questions to his class, and it became very disturbing to so many of them, till finally he was reported to the teachers of the school. And he told them that I'm just an academic man. An academic man has questions, and I have questions. But then when it got right down to it, he said, "We claim that the Quran is from Allah." He said, "But I doubt it." He said, "I see in it the thoughts of a man and not the thoughts of God." And with that, they said, "You blasphemer!" And terrible things were done to him over the next while. And he became convinced that the God of Islam is not the God of this created universe. He said, "It sent me into an incredible search." He said, "I went first of all to the Eastern religions. I checked into Hinduism. I looked into Buddhism. None of that was answering to what I was looking for. None of it was satisfying. None of it convinced me. And then I found one thing that really caught my attention." He said, "When I wanted to think, I would sit on the bank of the canal." And by the way, this is at the Nile in Egypt. This is the Nile River in Egypt. "And I would look at the water. Water, green plants, sky, nature, these gave me hope that there was some answer to my questions." And I said, "There it is." And it just sent chill bumps over me, because I thought, that's exactly Romans chapter 1. He said, "I looked at all of the things around me, and it just spoke to me, and it gave me hope that there is a God out there that I'm looking for. There are answers to my questions, and I will eventually find those answers." And he did. But that's the point of all of these things, is that one of the reasons I believe in God is because I can see him in the material world. I want you to think about the alternative to that kind of thinking. Somebody says, "No, what really happened was there was this compacted ball of matter that exploded and everything that is fell into place." Well, obviously the question is asked, well, where did that compacted ball of matter come from? And I have always thought there was good sense in the idea of, maybe here's a watch that I have on. I use my phone. I don't have a watch anymore, but... just the idea that somebody says, "Well, what happened was is there was this metal factory, and this metal factory just blew up, and all of these pieces of metal just shot up in the sky, and as they were falling, they fell together, and here came this watch." Nobody says that. Nobody says that, because everybody understands, no. When you look at a watch, it shows that somebody had intelligence. Somebody put things together in an orderly fashion. This was produced by somebody. We would never say a watch just came together, and yet people want to dare to say that this universe just came together by some kind of explosion. I have said before, though, that if you want to talk about an explosion, maybe it was this. God spoke and bang, it happened. That's what Genesis said. That God spoke, and everything that is came into existence. And then there's those who try to teach spontaneous generation, that everything living came from that which was non-living. Well, first of all, that's not even scientific. And that's never been observed anywhere, ever, that something living came from something that was non-living. What we see every day in our lives is we see life coming from life. And when you read the scriptures, that's exactly what you see as well. Turn to Luke, the third chapter. In Luke, the third chapter, we have the genealogy of Jesus through what is believed by many to be the genealogy of Mary. But if you were reading this, you'd begin in verse 23, and it would say that Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi, the son of Janna, the son of Joseph. And you'd get all these, the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of. But have you ever noticed what it does when it gets down to verse 38? The son of Enos, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. Living, coming from an ultimate source that is living. The true and the living God, who is eternal, has always been and always will be, who creates every single one of us. In Hebrews, the third chapter, in verse 4. Hebrews, the third chapter, in verse 4. I've always liked this because of how just down-to-earth common sense it is. Hebrews 3 and verse 4 just simply says that every house is built by someone. If you were walking through a very dense section of woods, and all of a sudden you came up on a house, you would not say, "Well, wow, can you believe what popped out of the ground?" All of us know that's not so. You come upon a house and you know that somewhere along the way, somebody was in this section of the woods and they built this house. Why? Because every house is built by someone. And then it says, "But he who built all things is God." Years ago, there was a piece that was put out by Cressy Morrison, who was a scientist. He wrote several books explaining why, as a scientist, he believed in God. And by the way, it's important for you to understand, if you're in academic circles, that there are a number of scientists who believe in God. Don't let anybody tell you, "Well, science says," as though we're going to point to those who say there is no God, and that's true science, whereas this other is just a bunch of malarkey. Here's what he says. "By unwavering mathematical law, we can prove that our universe was designed and executed by a great engineering intelligence. Suppose you took 10 pennies." You got this? Follow this right here. You take 10 pennies, you mark them from 1 to 10. So you mark 1 on 1, 2, 3. You've got them marked, and you put them into your pocket, and you give them a good shuffle. Now you are going to try to take them out in sequence from 1 to 10. That's not that hard, is it? Going to reach in your pocket, pull out the one that says 1. Put it back in, reach in, pull out the one that says 2. Put it back in, pull out the one that says 3. Doesn't seem very hard in a lot of ways, does it? He says, "Mathematically, we know that your chance of first drawing number 1 is 1 in 10. Of drawing 1 and 2 in succession is 1 to 100. Of drawing 1, 2, and 3 in succession is 1 in 1,000. And so on, your chance of drawing them all from number 1 to number 10 in succession would reach an unbelievable figure of 1 chance in 10 billion. You understand that? We're just talking 10 pennies. That's all we're talking, 10 pennies. The chances of pulling them out in succession from number 1 to number 10 is 1 chance in 10 billion. He says, "By the same reason, there are so many exacting conditions that are necessary for life on earth that they could not possibly exist in a proper relationship by chance. The earth rotates on its axis 1,000 miles an hour. If it turned 100 miles an hour, our days and nights would be 10 times as long as they are now, and the hot sun would burn up our vegetation each long day, while in the long night any surviving sprout would freeze. Again, the source of our life, the sun, has a surface temperature of 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and the earth is just far enough away so that this eternal fire warms us just enough and not too much. If the sun gave off only half of its present radiation, we would freeze. If it gave half as much more, we would roast." Just happens to be in the right spot, right? "The slant of the earth tilted at an angle of 23 degrees gives us our seasons. If it had not been so tilted, vapors from the ocean would move north and south, piling up for us continents of ice. If our moon was, say, only 50,000 miles away instead of its actual distance, our tides would be so enormous that twice a day all continents would be submerged. Even the mountains would soon be eroded away. If the crust of the earth had been only 10 feet thicker, there would be no oxygen, without which animal life would die. Had the ocean been a few feet deeper, carbon dioxide and oxygen would have been absorbed and no vegetable life could exist. If our atmosphere had been much thinner, some of the meteors that are now burning in space by millions every day would be striking all parts of the earth, setting fires everywhere. Because of these and a host of other examples, there is not one chance in millions that life on our planet is an accident." What's his argument? It is the just right planet. Because God made it, the scriptures say, to be inhabited. So I believe that there's a God because I can see Him in the material world. Shouts everywhere. But then there's a second thing. I can see Him in the animal world. And again, I have a hard time understanding how people can look at the animal world and not see the amazing design of God. In fact, a while back, I just watched a segment about the honeybee. And I've often said, you can take the honeybee by itself, just the honeybee. And I'm already sold. All the tremendous things that the honeybee does. In fact, they have come to realize that when the honeybee comes back to its comb, that sometimes we'll see that it'll come back and all the others will gather around this one that has been out and it's kind of moving back and forth like this. It almost looks like it's doing a little dance. And through much study, they have concluded that what he's doing is he is telling them the exact things that they need to know where the food source is. He's giving them directions as to where the food source is. Who gave that honeybee that knowledge? Who gave the honeybee the ability to do that? The Bible, I believe, does it. When you read the Bible, you think about how much the Bible uses the animal world. When God wants to talk about not being lazy, he says, go look at the ant. When he wants to talk about not worrying, he says, go look at the birds. When he wants to speak against alcohol, he talks about it at the last will bite you just like a serpent. The created world is God's teachers. And we can see so much. I decided to give you just one. This is referred to as an archer fish. It looks like an average kind of fish, doesn't it? But there's one thing that the archer fish can do that is quite amazing. The archer fish spits water. Here's an example of it. You see what looks like a pretty forceful stream of water going up from this archer fish as he does his mouth in just a certain way. And he sends a powerful stream of water out from beneath the water to something that he's trying to hit above the water. Here's an insect that's on a little branch. Archer fish comes along. And with deadly precision hits his mark. It falls into the water and then he's got his food. Here's a fish that spits water. There's an example of what we're talking about. Just below the surface, he spits the water. It goes up, it hits the fly falls down in the water, he's got his food. But there's something else you need to know. Light bends when it hits water. Sunlight will bend when it hits water. And so what you have is you have a situation here where light is coming down, it hits the water, and then it takes a turn. I started to bring this to give you an example. Get you a glass of water at home and put you a pencil in it and then look at it and it'll look like the pencil is bending. So somehow if this fish is going to hit the actual target, this is what he sees. This is the perceived target. It looks like it's here, but it's actually over here. Who gave that fish the ability to adjust, to spit exactly like he needs to get that fly? Who did that? Well, yeah, that's it. You said it. Amen to that. And you know what? You can see that. And the thing is, we're just talking about one fish. We could go on and on and on and on and on. Let me talk to you just a second here about the human eye. I'm going to read this. It's kind of complicated. I'm reading it because it is. But just listen. The eye can be compared to a video camcorder. A camcorder has a protective lens cover. The eye has an eyelid. The camcorder has a lens that is capable of automatically focusing at various distances. So does the eye. The camcorder senses the amount of light that it is receiving, and it will adjust its aperture to ensure that the picture is neither over nor underexposed. The eye also senses these variations and adjusts the opening in front of the eye accordingly. The camcorder will convert the images it sees into patterns of electric current. The current is then converted into magnetic code that is recorded upon the videotape. For playback, the video head translates the magnetic code into patterns of electric current, which in turn are converted into television signals. The eye, on the other hand, receives reflected light through the pupil and focuses the image onto the back of the eye or the retina with its lens. The retina is covered with a layer of tall, tightly packed cells. These cells are two types, rods and cones. Each eye contains about 100 million rod cells that are extra sensitive to dim light and yet see in black and white, and about 3 million cone cells that are responsible for seeing color. As light is focused upon these rods and cones, it is observed and absorbed and converted into electrical signals. The signals are processed by a computer-like network of interneurons that enhances the information before sending it to the brain. Of course, all of this is done within the fraction of a second. Nobody looks at a camcorder and says, "Well, I guess that just happened." Everybody understands that somebody with an extremely intelligent mind had to make that thing work. Who did the eye? Who did this? And yet, again, it's remarkable what it does. Last night I was just noticing, you know, that I can be looking right here. I can be looking right here, and my eye is focused on it. I can look up at Christopher, and there's no, you know. You know, when I look up at Christopher, bang, I'm focused. Look back down, bang, I'm focused. The speed in which our eyes focus from up, down, up, amazing. Who did that? Who did that? Again, we could go on and on. Think about your hand. Scientists now have made mechanical hands, but I'm told that that cost about $10,000. But they say to replace every part of your body that can be replaced with artificial parts would cost you about $25 million. If you replaced every part of a person's body with things that had been made by men, it would cost $25 million. He's everywhere. Tell me where God ain't. He's everywhere. And that's the point of all of that. Let me give you a final point. Because my heart gropes for God. I see Him in the material world. I see Him in the animal world. And my heart gropes for Him. I just find myself yearning for God. In Acts 17, beginning in verse 24, I believe this is teaching that we're built that way, that God has put eternity in our hearts. And in Acts 17, beginning in verse 24, it says, "God who made the world and everything in it, since He is the Lord of heaven and earth, He does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He worshipped with men's hands as though He needed anything, since He gives to all life and breath and all things. And He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us." That's exactly right. And one of the things you're going to find is in every society of man, you see that the human heart craves for God. Now, they may come up with something that's not the true God. They may create something in their imagination that's not the true God. But what you find is over here in this country, they talk about God. And over here in this country, they talk about God. And over there, they talk about God. It's universal. Everybody's groping for God. And Acts 17 says that God did that in the hopes that we would grope for Him, and groping for Him, we would find Him. And He's not far from each one of us. The atheist is the exception in every society. That yearning comes from God. And then I think about this. I think about morals. It seems that most everybody, when it gets right down to it, will talk about something that's right and something that's wrong. People may disagree on the line, but most people will talk about what's right and what's wrong. Where does that come from? And it starts very early. A child gets a chair taken away from them by another child. They say, "You give that back. That's my chair." That's my notebook. Where'd that come from? Where's that sense of fairness coming from? Where does morality, right and wrong, come from? Dogs and cats don't seem to do it. I've never seen a cat chase a dog. No, excuse me, backwards. Never seen a dog chase a cat. And then after that cat has run off frantically, the dog gets over there under a tree and he looks like he's worried about something, and you inquire about it and you find out that he's saying, "I've just got to work on it. I got to work on that. I'm just too mean to that cat." They don't do that. We do. We seem to have a sense of right and wrong. In Genesis 1, verse 26 and 27, "I believe it is because we are made in the image of God." Verse 26, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." God made us in his image. The God of morality. The God of Matthew 5 through 7, where Jesus Christ, the Son of God, gives us the greatest ethical code that's ever been given to the world. In Romans chapter 2, and verse 14, "Even the Gentile world, without a written code, understood that there was a God." In Romans 2 and verse 14, it says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law," that is the law of Moses, "by nature they do the things contained in the law, these also, not having the law, are a law to themselves. They show the work of the law in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them." It's saying the Gentile world understands that certain things are right and wrong, and their conscience kicks in and tells them that certain things are wrong and certain things are right. Bottom line is, if there is no God, there is no standard. Do we understand that? If there is no God, there is no standard. Who are you to tell me what's right and what's wrong? If there is no God, there is no standard. Jeffrey Dahmer cannibalized a number of boys. Later on, he said, "I had been taught evolution," and he had turned away from that in prison. He said, "I had been taught evolution, and evolution told me that there was no God. If there was no God, then who was to say that what I was doing was right or wrong? And furthermore, if there is no God, I'm not going to be held accountable for anything that I do." And that's not to say that every evolutionist is that kind of animal. But it is to say that evolution has some terrible consequences in it, if it's true. If there is no God, there is no standard. At the Nuremberg trial, the Germans, in defending what they had done to the Jews, said this: "Our society had its own needs and desires. Our society made up its own laws based on those needs and desires. Our society commanded us to exterminate the Jews. It would have been wrong for us not to have obeyed. But now you try to condemn us with a law of an alien society, a value system which has absolutely nothing to do with us. You are therefore condemning us by the use of an ex post facto law which you force upon us." What they're saying is we had no law that ever said that was wrong, and you're trying to bring the laws of a Western world or a United States of America or whatever, and you're trying to impose that upon us. And the answer was, by the prosecution, "These men should be tried on this basis, on a higher law which rises above the provincial and the transient." And what they're saying is, no, we're not trying you by any kind of strange law. We're trying you by the highest law of all, and that is God. And the atrocities in which you have done against men. I have often wondered just how many hardcore atheists there really are. I think most of them know better. It's like old Ingersoll, the famous agnostic, debated, if there's a God in heaven, I'll give him just 5 minutes to strike me down for saying there is no God. And he said he's watched down, and they watched for 5 minutes as people got terribly nervous. Nothing happened after 5 minutes, and he said, my point is proven, there is no God. Somebody on the way out came across a reporter, and a reporter said, well, what do you think about the performance of Mr. Ingersoll tonight? And their response was, did that infidel think that he could exhaust the eternal patience of an eternal God in 5 minutes? It's reported that on his deathbed, Ingersoll said, oh God, if there be a God, save my soul if I have a soul. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know this. Deep down, I believe most of them know better. It's just in us. But the question is, why does it even matter? Why should I care? And I realize I'm preaching to the choir, as some people sometimes put it. If atheism is true, your creator is dirt. If atheism is true, you are nothing more than a glob of tissue and you have no real purpose. If atheism is true, there is no standard of right and wrong. If it's true, there are no obligations that you have to anybody. And if atheism is true, then death is the end of every single one of us. And there will be no judgment for the worst kind of people. It's what you have. On the other hand, if there is a God, then He is our Creator. We are here for a purpose. There is a standard of right and wrong, a standard of good and evil. There are obligations that we have toward other people. Death is just the beginning of an eternal existence. And you will give an account, and I will, for the way that we have lived. Vast differences. No God? God. It matters, doesn't it? What do you believe? I've told you what I believe and why I believe it. What do you believe? Reasons for the existence of God. And these are things that we can easily share with other people as we try to help them to come to a better understanding of the God of heaven. If you're here this morning and you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, we're going to sing a song now to encourage you in obedience to the gospel. We ask you to think seriously about the need to come to Him, to come to Him before it's too late. There's such a finality to it when the Lord says, depart from me, I never knew you. Or to hear Him say, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the gospel, come to the Lord. Would you come while we stand and as we sing?